Welcome to the Swedish Innovation Podcast, where we export Swedish unicorness.
No buzzwords, just real life stories with Sweden's most innovative thinkers and doers. A podcast made by me, Sandra Bourbon.
And me, Sara Hermansson.
Today we will talk to Martin Daniels. He is an ex-Boston Consulting Group Management Consultant that worked as Chief Innovation Officer and Deputy CEO of Synsam Group. Synsam is one of the Nordic's most successful companies when it comes to eye fashion and eye health and optics. They have over 500 stores in Nordics. In 2021, Synsam reached almost a revenue of 5 billion SEK. And what is interesting is that some years ago, they completely changed here. So a lot, almost half of the revenue today comes from subscriptions. And we will talk more about Martin about how they did that transformation. With Martin, we'll talk about like how can you succeed as a chief innovation officer. I know you are a lot of people out there like wondering how can I succeed in this role. Maybe you were appointed, but it's very, very hard to drive innovation. Martin will share all of his best advice how you can succeed as a chief innovation officer and how they have done at Synsam. We talk a lot about culture and leadership and how they are organized at Synsam. I think you will find this very inspiring as I did. And I also, maybe you hear on my voice, I have a bit of a cold, but I think you will find this episode very interesting anyway, because Martin will do most of the talking and me, Sandra Bourbon, will ask the questions. So let's talk to Martin. Welcome to the Swedish Innovation Podcast, Martin Daniels.
Yes, thank you.
So you are an ex-BCG consultant and you now work as a Chief Innovation Officer and Deputy CEO at Synsam. Like, for the people that doesn't know, what is Synsam and why do you exist?
Synsam Group is the leading Nordic optical retailer. We are over 50 years old as a business. We operate in 500 owned stores in Sweden, Norway, Denmark, and Finland. And the reason why we exist is because we have a growing problem with vision correction. People are getting older and they need glasses to a larger and larger extent. So our sort of mission or reason for being is to help that solve that problem.
I actually got my first pair of glasses just, I don't know, a month ago. I should have had them for many years, but I kind of, you know, no, I'm not old, I don't want them. But now I have them and I'm super happy. I don't have a headache anymore, so it's very, very good.
You were in the denial phase. Now you've accepted.
Yeah. Now I have accepted. So it's okay. Yeah. Cool. And like for ordinary day, like what do you do at Synsam?
So I have a number of great colleagues operating a number of different business areas. But I would say the overarching summary is trying to support business colleagues in the ongoing business, and also to generate new ideas, test, pilot, evaluate new business opportunities. Synsam as a company, we're very focused on innovation and developing our offering, all parts of the business. So a lot of focus is spent on how can we improve, how can we be better at serving customers, reaching customers, and so on. So it's a combination of supporting an ongoing business and looking a bit into the future and trying new things and supporting that process.
Great. I think it's super interesting that you are here now to talk with us, because you are Chief Innovation Officer, and a lot of people that we have talked to before and you joined this episode is that maybe you get appointed as like a Chief Innovation Officer. It sounds good on the paper, but then you are there in like your organization and it's really hard to drive innovation, to lead innovation. And what would you say is like the prerequisites that you need as a leader to succeed as a with innovation, or as you have done at least in, at Synsam?
Yeah, but I think you're pinpointing something which is a common issue or challenge for people in this role, that you're sort of appointed to drive innovation, and you perhaps you have a team of some you know, smart people coming up with great ideas, but not really getting through in the organization and not really creating the impact, not really exploiting the opportunity that's out there. So I think for us, and I think some general learnings that can be exported to other businesses, is it's not really about just that innovation team and or you as a person sort of coming up with great ideas and setting up sort of new structures.
But are you an innovation team? Like, how are you organized?
So I mean, we don't have a dedicated team. I mean, I have some business developers in a team working with, you know, driving new projects. But what we have done is we've tried to get innovation, the way of thinking about the business, trying to constantly innovate the business in, you know, big and small aspects into all parts of our company. And for us, it all starts with, and I think that's very important, it starts with a CEO, in our case, having a really, really strong view that we need to be innovative, we need to develop the business, because that's the only way we can sort of become, remain relevant. So you need really, really from the top down a support for, you know, the innovative culture. If you don't have that, it doesn't matter how smart you are and how many great ideas you come up with, if you don't have that clear vision from the top that this is really part of the core values of Synsam. We have three sort of value statements: customer first, innovation, and responsibility. And I think for us, it may sound cheesy that you have some words on a PowerPoint, but getting that into the DNA of every employee is super important to get innovation to work. And innovation doesn't have to be, you know, the cutting edge AI technology that's sort of disrupting the business. It's also about the small things, you know, small process changes, ways to meet the customers in the store. So really getting that innovation into everyone's, you know, DNA is super important. So I would say culture and leadership is much more important than, you know, we have a certain way of working within the innovation team.
You joined Synsam 2014. It's quite many years ago, and you've done like a tremendous, change, a transformation of Synsam as a business. And then I guess in the future, when you started 2014, did you have the same values then, or how did you implement it, you know, for the people listening out there? Okay, this because usually, as you say, these words stay on a PowerPoint, right? You have them on a wall and nobody cares, but like, how do you do so people really live this culture and words?
So for us it was a couple of things. One, of course, going back a bit in time then to 2015, when our new CEO came on board, when he joined, we sort of set a new strategy and we defined the vision, mission, the sort of value statements that went on a PowerPoint first, by the way. And then two things happened. I mean, one is you really need to translate those words that are, you know, cliche type of words into something meaningful for your employees. And I'm sitting in the headquarters and we have 3,500 people out in 500 stores. What does the words really mean to the colleagues out in the stores? That needs to be translated.
Did you use these people when you formulated the words, or did you like push them out? Do you understand like how I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I think you always need to listen to the colleagues out in the stores and also customers. So we did a lot of fact finding when we defined the strategy, both on what do consumers think about Synsam, what needs to change, what does our employees think our strengths and weaknesses are, and you know, so where we need to go. So you take that as input, but then as a management team and as a CEO, what our CEO did was to sort of set the vision, and then from that vision, distill a number of value words. So and then what we did then is to with a strong HR director that we have in place. Really translate those words into something that was meaningful for our store personnel. So really, what does innovation mean? What does taking responsibility mean? What does putting the customer first really mean in a very tangible way for me in the store? So that's sort of one way. And then for the headquarter, for the people in the headquarter really coming up with the new concepts and ideas, we broke sort of a organizational hierarchical structure, which was very much focused on, you know, someone is responsible for marketing, someone is responsible for products, etc., etc. People tend to work in silos with that sort of traditional structure. What we did was to break that structure, create, you know, a project focused company focusing on what needs to happen for us to really move this company from where it was to where it needs to be. So from 15 and a sort of hierarchical structure, we moved into a project-based network type of organization, where we now, when we come up with an idea, we put together a team of people from different functions, and we create a project around it. And that is sort of one of the sort of success factors for us, that we sort of broke that hierarchical model and really got into everyone's mind, and now I'm talking about headquarters, that we all need to be engaged in business development projects, call it innovation or call it whatever you want, but someone from marketing, someone from product, someone from HR, someone from IT, someone from business development, get together, you put the right type of resources in place, and then you can sort of rebuild the store format, you can develop a subscription model, you can develop own brands, whatever it was that needed to be done, we sort of went from a hierarchical model to a project-based model. And that was sort of an important shift for us in really getting the change to happen.
I want to talk more about this subscription model that you just mentioned a little bit later, but you said like we choose an idea, we put together this team. How do you choose the ideas, which one to pursue?
So I think this is also about you know, really getting first of all, getting the innovative mindset into the people in the company. And the second thing is having people from different backgrounds with different perspectives in the room. So for us, it's not really about a structured model where, you know, once a month we spend an afternoon in sort of brainstorming sessions. For us, it's innovation is about constantly developing everything we do. So if I'm responsible for, you know, the subscription model, if I'm responsible for Synsam Sports, whatever it is, it's my responsibility to not only manage the ongoing business, but to constantly develop the offering. So for the subscription, for example, and this is just one of the examples of how we're working with innovation, we launched in 2016 a 1.0 version. That then, you know, we learned a lot of things from launching it into the market. We then developed the 2.0 version, learned a bit more. The model was more adapted to customer needs, etc. So that's how we work with everything we do. We work with the 1.0, 2.0, 3.0 version of the offering.
And now you'll have a 5.0 this year,
exactly,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So I think it's super interesting, this subscription model, because that I feel a lot of leaders out there have problem. Like, you find this new value or like a thing that you want to launch to your customers, but the subscription that will cannibalize like on your existing business of selling glasses, right? So, but the subscription model, how did you pursue? Because now I know it's like a hit, right? It's 46% of your revenue, and like sales of a counter is 48%, right? So it's basically half of the sales. And how did you go upon taking that decision, or did you have any resistance at all? Guessing like with your culture.
Sorry, I didn't hear the last word. Did we have any resistance in the organization?
Yeah, because it's like, okay, let's pursue the subscriptions model now. That's kind of a huge shift that will cannibalize on the sales over counter for glasses.
Yeah. So a couple of things. I mean, first on the sort of decision making process and why we decided to do it. I mean, it all started with really understanding customer needs. So I said that we always have a customer first perspective in everything we do. So when we launched the new strategy back in 2015, part of the, you know, some of the key insights from the consumer surveys we did was that the industry, optical retail industry, hadn't really succeeded in meeting all the customer needs. So what does that really mean? And well, it means that typically someone wearing glasses will buy one pair of glasses every 3 to 5 years. And the reason for buying a new pair is typically, you know, in 80% of the cases that their vision changed. And it's like an auditor. It's an expense that most people don't, you know, look forward to spending, but it's something that you need to do. I mean, you need to have, you know, good vision to function in life. So we saw that really buying glasses was more of a sort of pain point than something positive. And then the second thing is we saw also that customers actually had more needs. They had needs for sports glasses, prescription sunglasses, reading glasses. They might also want different styles of their frames, but most people bought one pair of glasses. And the reason for that was that, you know, because the vision changes in an unpredictable way, people only spend money on one pair of glasses, even though they need more. So there was a customer need that wasn't really fulfilled by the industry. And then we had seen the subscription model working in other industries, for example, in cars, etc., with private leasing. So we took that model from other industries and applied it to the optical retail industry because there was actually a customer need that wasn't met.
And you were first launching the subscription model for glasses.
Yeah, in the way it was set up, we were global pioneers. And yeah. I mean, to your question about resistance, it's the idea in itself is like 5% of the value creation. 95% is getting it to really work and implement it. So a lot of time, money and effort is of course spent on educating our staff, communicating with our staff, being really clear on why we're doing it, explaining it, because if it doesn't pass through our colleagues in the stores, if they don't really understand it, if they don't like it, they're not going to be able to sell it. So that was super important for us to really get our colleagues in the stores to understand it and to see the benefit for the customers. And that was sort of a very important part of the success. And then, as you said, of course, there was resistance and some people didn't really understand it. For some people, it took longer time. But we knew from customer insight that this was something that the customers really liked. And it's been a success ever since 2016. Now we have, you know, over 400,000 subscribers in the program and growing every month. So,
yeah, that's a crazy growth.
Yeah, execution and implementation is really, really the key to getting the value from great ideas.
I know that sustainability is also very important for CSAM, and as you said, responsibility. How do you see like subscription model of glasses when people have like a lot of them go hand in hand with sustainability of like trying to consume less?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I think it's there is a trade-off or of course a conflict between being a commercial player and selling things. You might argue that the most sustainable thing is not to sell anything, to not produce anything. But for us, it's really about creating a positive impact in customers' life. It's really about the life quality of helping them see well and feel better and so on. So in doing that, because we have really a clear reason for being, how can we then operate in a as sustainable as possible? So we have a couple of ways we're trying to reduce our environmental footprint. I mean, first of all, in the subscription, you're allowed to, I mean, the subscription is based on having three or more products, typically three pair of glasses or two pair of glasses and a contact lens solution. Every year you're allowed to exchange one pair and hand one pair back.
What do you do with that pair then?
Yeah, exactly. So that is sort of isn't that driving overproduction, overconsumption? So what we're doing then with that volume is we have created a circular model where these frames go into a fully dedicated second-hand channel called Synsam Recycling Outlet, which now has about 15 stores, where we sell these glasses second-hand. So instead of throwing them away or reusing the material, we're actually giving them a second life. So with that, we have also an incentive to create a product that quality-wise lasts longer, and then because a second customer can use them, that can actually reduce our footprint on the environment. Because rather than buying a new pair of glasses, someone can buy a second pair, a second-hand pair. So that's one thing. And then we're trying to, of course, reduce or reutilize recycled materials. We have a collection made out of recycled ocean plastic. We have circular collections where we're using old materials to create new frames. And we are, as you've probably seen, taking back production for our own brands from Asia and Italy, moving it to Sweden this year to reduce the transportation and also to phase in more sustainable materials over time. So it's super important for us because it's important for customers. We become, more attractive in the eyes of consumers. It's also, a responsibility for us as a business to try to take part in driving the change. And thirdly, it's also attracting employees to Synsam. So, I mean, I think it's a win-win. Making a sustainable choice can also be, economically sustainable, and it needs to be. Because otherwise, it's going to be an issue to drive that change.
Yeah, we had Josefina Salén from Rise talking about circular business models some episodes ago. And then she really talks exactly about what you have mentioned now. That with a subscription, you need to focus on the quality so it will last longer. And she said, like, you want to use your products like many times and for as long as possible before you need to recycle them. That's basically how you can be more sustainable. So very interesting to hear how you work with this. You touched upon it a little bit, like how do you hire all these innovative people? Or maybe they're not super innovative before they start. Like how do you go upon the recruitment and then maybe onboarding personnel?
So I think it's both. I think, I mean, if you're successful in building an innovative culture, you're going to attract sort of the right type of people, if you understand what I mean. And the second thing is, I mean, I think recruitment is probably one of the 3 to 5 most critical processes in building a good business. So we take it super seriously. We have a lot of management attention on key roles. We have, for example, if you look at Sweden, our country manager is part of every store manager recruitment in the country. So we really try to make sure from top down that we engage in the recruitment process. And then of course we look a lot for sort of the right type of attitude. I mean,
how do you do that?
I mean, there are questions and questionnaires, but we train our employees who are supposed to do recruitment, and both on the sort of methodology, but also to really take it seriously. Because, I mean, in retail, typically it's not uncommon that as a store manager, for example, you just need to fill a vacancy and you might know someone and then you hire them. We know that having the right people in place is the most important driver for our commercial success. So looking for attitude, personality rather than experience is for us really the choice. And then I think also, for example, if I look at our management team and the way our CEO compiled the management team, it's really about having people with different backgrounds, different perspectives in the same room. So you cannot have, for example, I'm coming from a management consultancy background. You cannot have 5 or 10 management consultants in the same room. They might really understand each other, but you need people from different backgrounds. So we have, our creative director coming from fashion, you have HR people, our HR director, not grown up in HR, but in marketing and communications. So you have a lot of different people in the room to really have different perspectives on things. And I think those are some keys for us to really drive a good recruitment and build strong teams.
You have touched upon it a little bit so far, but like when it comes to, we talked a little about like leadership and culture. How do you as a leader, like what kind of leadership do you think you need to succeed with innovation?
Well, I mean, you really need to instill the feeling in people that it's okay to fail. And it also, it's a typical cliche that you probably hear from a lot of people in this role, but it's one that's actually true, because for us, really getting people to not only come up with ideas but dare to try them out in the real world, and in our case that's in our stores, that's the only way to see if it's going to fly or not. So we've built a culture where, it's we're very quick to, implement a pilot, and we often work with pilots and a 1.0 version, and it might be a version that's not, really scalable it might require, you know, a lot of manual work behind the curtain or at the headquarters to manage something. But for example, when we see it working, we then invest to create that, you know, scalable backend, for example, for it to work. So I think we generate a lot of ideas and we're quick to test them out in the stores.
Do you test it in one store or several stores, or does it depend?
It depends on what it is, and you know, we have four different markets. Sometimes we test it in all markets, sometimes we start with one market, a region, or even one store. So it all depends what it is. And then of course you also need to be structured enough or disciplined enough to close down things that, you know, after a certain period of time you conclude that they're not really working. So I think it's about that. For us, it's not about idea generation, but it's about, you know, getting things out there into the market and seeing if it works and daring to try it.
How do you do, like, a person comes with an idea, like, okay, this, I believe it would be very good for Synsam, blah, 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 and they have maybe some kind of, yeah, they present it somehow. And you're like, nay. This we will not pursue this right now. Like, how do you take that discussion? Will they get some feedback? Because you cannot pursue all ideas that you get.
Yeah, of course. I mean, and I think if we've created a culture where people come up with ideas and they present them, and then as you're saying, sometimes, you know, the timing is not right, and you need to prioritize also between different ideas and projects, both from a resource and, you know, time and money perspective. So I think as long as you're transparent and explaining, you know, some things, you know, we're not going to pursue, and sometimes some things are good, but we might do it a bit later. I think if you're transparent with that, it's fine. And it's not like people expect that everything is going to be turned into a project that we're going to try. Some ideas are not, you know, might sound good, but they don't work, even though the person is really passionate about the idea. Sometimes you just have to say no as well. So I think it depends on what it is and the timing and so on. But if it's a great idea, we fast track it and we put a team around it, and we try to be fast to put it out there in the market. I would say we are, when we find something that we believe in, we don't want to wait for, you know, the next quarter or so, because we don't have resources. Then we find a way to put resources towards that idea.
Do you have any statistics, like what the success rate for the things that you pilot? Is it, as you say, like for startups, is 1 out of 10 that works? Maybe it's higher for you, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, we're a more mature player in that sense. So I think we have a higher hit rate, and probably we have, you know, more things that are closer to our core business, which are sort of things that are more conventional in that way. So I think we probably have a success rate of over 50% of the things we do. But there are also, you know, how do you define success? It might be that you have to tweak something, and, you know, it might, you could see it as a second idea or a 2.0 version of the same idea. So we do a lot of tweaks. I mean, I can tell you that when, for example, we launched our store concept back in 15, the 1.0 version, we're now at store concept version 14, and we're opening a lot of new stores, and almost every time we open a new store, we make at least a number of changes between that store and the previously opened store, because we find things all the time on, you know, how you display things, new digital technology, screens, etc., that can be put in place, the number of SKUs you put into certain store, etc. So it's a constant evolution and innovation of everything we do.
Back to the ideas, like how do you make sure to collect ideas that, let's say that you work in a store kind of far away from the headquarters, like geographically as well, how do you make sure to collect all the ideas?
So, I mean, a couple of things. One is have some sort of pipeline into the headquarters. Can be through the intranet, where you can sort of post ideas, both, you know, things that are working and things that are not working, and things that can be improved. So that's one way to sort of engage and to stimulate people sharing ideas. And then, of course, there's a sort of hierarchical way of talking to your store manager or region manager, or even just contacting someone at the headquarters. If you have an idea for, you know, a brand that you think we need to add to the assortment, we want people to be able to contact our category manager and so on. So, I mean, creating those channels for communication and then stimulating idea generation in the way we communicate with our colleagues. You know, just saying that it is important. We need input from our colleagues in the stores, because that's where, you know, the reality happens. That's where we meet our customers. So that is super important platform and arena for us to generate ideas for improvements.
You talked about this, it should be okay to fail. Do you have a story, like what's the biggest fail you have encountered, or like maybe you have done in your role as you have right now?
I mean, I like the question, because you always, typically you're asked about, you know, the successes and so on. But I mean, of course, we've done a lot of things that, you know, was wrong, or that was sort of evolved into something that was better. So if you take something, and I think we talked about things that have improved over time, like the subscription or like the store form and so on. But one thing that we did back in 15-16 that was, you know, that was just wrong, was we saw in customer insight that the main issue for a customer when coming into a store and when they were looking for that, you know, frame to buy, that it was difficult to really find that one frame without, you know, having support from someone in the store, an expert or a salesperson or an optician. So how could we? So we thought about how can we make it easier for customers to find, you know, frame that fits their needs. And then at the same time, we had, you know, a lot of discussion around digitalization, and we found this virtual try-on tool. We built an app that could work on your cell phone, so you can virtually try out the assortment, you know, from your home. And then we thought, you know, this technology is so great that why don't we put it into our stores? So when we launched the first store format, and we rolled this out into quite a lot of stores, we put in two iPads and a stand where customers could virtually try out all the frames in the assortment.
So maybe some frames that you hadn't in the store, but you have them in storage, so you can send them from another store, or that can also be a benefit.
Yeah, that could be a benefit. Yeah, but for most people, you know, if you're good at curating the assortment, you should have something in the store for most people. Mm. So it's like sort of the technology in the application was good, but when we got people into the store, we wanted to drive them to find a frame to try it on their actual face. Mm. So that sort of technology that we put into this physical store, it was outright wrong. I mean, the application was great when you're sitting on the bus trying out sunglasses, etc., but not in the store. So we had to, because it was sort of driving the wrong type of behavior. People were sitting in front of the screen rather than you know, engaging with our sales personnel and opticians. So we had to take it out from you know, hundreds of stores and put in more frames on that, in that place in the store. So that was just one thing that, you know, we found a customer need, tried to solve it, but the way we did it was in the wrong way. But at the same time, you need to do these type of things, because otherwise, in my view, you're not running fast enough if you're not allowing yourself to make these mistakes, because then you're overthinking things and you're not really acting, doing things. So I think decision making, piloting things, trying out things, and then fine tuning is much, much better than not trying things.
If you would do it again, like, would you roll it out in less stores, or would you do exactly the same?
At the same time, I mean, we rolled out in 18 months a completely new store format in almost all of our stores. Yeah. And that had a huge positive impact on, you know, the visibility of our stores, the attractiveness of our stores, drove a lot of traffic and sales. So I would do it again. I mean, and of course, of course, I wouldn't want to make the same mistake, knowing it was a mistake. But I mean, approach-wise, I would think the same. Rather do it faster and fine-tune and take some, you know, some cost, because there's a lot of benefit that you get from the speed and trying things.
I know that you have stylists now. They're, you're kind of famous. You want to go to your store because you want to have seen some stylist to help you pick out your the frames. I know I have a neighbor here, and they went to see some for the first time, and she was so happy because her husband, like, oh my god, he looks so good in his new like frames now, because they were too like broad before, and as like just a private person, it's tricky. So what is how you sold it, or because that I think helps the customer to really choose the frames, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and you're right on point, because buying glasses every 3 to 5 years, you're not as used to picking out one pair of frames every 5 years as you are, for example, buying, you know, a shirt or a pair of trousers. You know that in this brand, I always have this size and so on. So you come into the store with, you know, a large need for advice in terms of, you know, what color, what size and so on fits my face. And and that's one of the reasons for why this category is, you know, so much a physical store based business. And then in that, of course, you need to have people then trained to really know how to fit a frame to your individual face. Because it might be that in my case, I have a broad face or a small nose, that, you know, picking the wrong frame can really create a negative impression of you as a customer. And you also feel that, you know, I don't really like these glasses. So that's super important. And I think one of the problems that a lot of retailers are doing when they're seeing their business going online is that they are reducing, you know, education, they're reducing the number of people in the store. They are focusing less on building an attractive store concept when you need to do the opposite. So we spent a lot of money in a new store format to create an attractive environment. We spent a lot of focus and effort on not only recruiting the right people, but training them to really understand these things so that they can fit the frame on your neighbor's husband, and he can be super happy, because that's going to create customer satisfaction, and that drives loyalty in the end. So long answer to a question, but I think, yes, I mean, that style expertise is super important for our sales personnel. And equally important is for the optician to have the medical expertise to recommend what type of lens do I need. There are a lot of different technical features that you can choose between, and what is really my need and which product fits that need.
Mm. What is the next step for Synsam and you as a chief innovation officer?
So now we're since about half a year, we're a listed company. So that comes with some restrictions in terms of talking about the future. But what we have said and what's sort of out there is that we have a strong momentum in the Nordics. We are taking market share across all four countries. We're continuing to open new stores. Even though we have 500 stores, there's still a lot of room for us to grow with new stores. We're seeing that we have an offering that, you know, can really gain traction. Even though there are opticians in a certain city, when we establish a new store, we can see that we can ramp up and really create a profitable operation. So I think rolling out new stores is one important part of our strategy. Second thing is, you know, taking the next steps in terms of sustainability with the opening of our production and innovation center in Sweden this year, where we are going to produce our own brands. That's an important initiative for us. And then thirdly, the ongoing development of everything we do with the offering, our employees, the stores, and so on, the digital side of things, constantly improving that is a third thing, I would say. So there are a lot of interesting things ahead.
What will you do in this innovation center?
So, I mean, the first thing is, of course, to produce frames. So we have about 10 own brands that represent half of our sales volume. And that's being produced in Asia and Italy, like all other frames from external brands as well. So that's one thing, that we're going to produce that volume ourselves. We're going to phase in more sustainably locally sourced materials. And the innovation part that's going to be in that innovation center is really focusing on new production methods, new materials, and also on the education in terms of eye health. So, of course, the optical side and the growing issue of eye health among the population is something where we as a company can expand our role. So we are going to go into, you know, new ways of supporting eye health, and you know, it can be R&D and other things in that center. So there are going to be a number of things, starting with production and innovation around production and products, and then also the eye health aspect.
How many frames or glasses will you produce per year here in the start?
So it's going to be a ramp up over a number of years, but the capacity in the site is going to be about 1 million or above 1 million frames per year. And we've communicated that we are going to have around 200 employees when we're fully ramped up.
Mm. Okay, great. Last question. Martin, your top tip for all innovation leaders out there that want to like help their company be more innovative?
Mm. Okay, so three things then is make sure that you really establish innovation as part of the company's DNA. And it's difficult for you to do it. You need the support from the CEO, and the CEO needs to be really behind your vision. So make sure that you spend a lot of time in aligning and getting, ideally, the CEO to really be innovative from the start. That's one thing. The second thing is start with the customer in mind. Everything, all ideas, needs to add some value to the customer. You cannot add you know, digital tools, whatever it is, from a sort of technology perspective, for example, needs to be adding customer value. And the third thing is, don't be afraid to try out things, pilot things, think about the 1.0 version, doesn't have to be perfect. You can improve over time. So dare to try and dare to fail.
Thank you so much, Martin, for joining Swedish Innovation and sharing all these valuable tips with us. And if people want to connect with you, is it okay if I put your LinkedIn profile in the show notes so people can connect with you there?
Absolutely.
Great. Thank you so much and have a nice day and good luck with your with the future. Yeah.
Thank you, Sandra.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. If you like what we're doing, remember to subscribe. And if you really like our podcast, don't forget to give us a 5-star rating. Remember, innovation is what makes the impossible possible, and it will all start with you.